To understand the different ways this heat wave in Arizona is punishing people, consider the story of Lauro Hilario. The intrepid street vendor drives a golf cart across the Phoenix asphalt for several hours a day, selling cold drinks, snow cones, and snacks to people he finds walking the streets.
Elotes, mangos, raspados.
Problem is, hardly anyone walks the street when it's 110 degrees outside. Phoenix just suffered through the hottest month ever recorded in an American city. And during the heat wave, Hilario says his sales fell to just $50 a day, when normally he'd make three times that.
Pues mal, porque no sale la gente en el día a comprar.
That's thousands of dollars of lost revenue at a time when electric bills are soaring. Long before this heat descended on the state and made life miserable for people like Hilario, researchers have been looking for ways to protect American cities from extreme temperatures. But first, they have to know exactly how hot it really is, which is why, on an early morning in late June, I drove north of Phoenix to meet an AmeriCorps member named Owen Kerslake. He's on a one-year assignment in the postcard-perfect tourist mecca of Sedona.
Had you ever been to Sedona or even heard of it before?
I actually had never even heard of Sedona before, but then I saw some pictures and I was sold pretty quickly.
I bet you were.
As the sun splashes its first rays of the day on the city's famous red rocks, Kerslake is busy attaching a temperature probe to the window of his car.
There we go.
Since 2017, government scientists at NOAA have sponsored projects like this one to identify the hottest parts of more than 70 communities across the country. At 6 a.m. sharp, Kerslake and his navigator, Sean Smith, will start driving a 9-mile route, recording a new temperature reading once every second. By the end of the day, he and a group of volunteers will have mapped the vast majority of the city.
That's really the goal here, is to help the community adapt to these extreme heat events, which, as we know, are becoming more frequent and intense with climate change. Through that lens, I think this can really be seen as a public health project. Oh, here we are, 6 o'clock. So let's get started here.
As our drive gets underway, one thing is clear. Sedona is not Phoenix. The temperature outside is in the 50s. I'm wearing a sweater as the car traverses the vegetated hillside of an upscale neighborhood. We drive through the shade of juniper trees and into the cool canyons of Oak Creek, where the cottonwoods grow tall. The day's forecast calls for temperatures in the 90s, and our navigator, Sean Smith, says Sedona does get dangerously hot.
Anytime you're, you know, in the street on the asphalt, it's just, it bakes, you know, your shoes. You can just feel kind of heat exuding all around you.
It is true that people die of heat exposure in the higher elevations of northern Arizona, but the numbers pale in comparison to the deserts of central Arizona. Last year, the heat claimed a record 425 lives in the Phoenix area, and this year, it's likely to be worse.
We have left here. Natural curve.
Still, logging heat data in Sedona helps understand how hot weather affects the entire state, according to Erin Ann Saffel. She's the state climatologist.
Everyone is familiar with Phoenix and how hot that gets in the center. But what happens is that every city, every town builds their own heat island.
Saffel says even in Sedona, the asphalt streets and concrete buildings hold on to the day's heat long after the sun goes down. That's what she means by urban heat island.
So I measured the asphalt last night. It was 145 degrees at 3 o'clock. I measured this sidewalk here. It was 130 degrees. I measured those red rocks. They were 130 degrees. So the air temperature was 90 degrees. But those different surfaces really build into that heat island.
All that heat is dangerous over time. Sustainability coordinator Zachary Schwartz says Sedona can use the new data to plant trees or build cooling centers in the city's hottest neighborhoods.
Another reason we care about this is we also have, I think, 3 million tourists a year. They don't necessarily all come from, the desert. They might not know that it's not safe to go hiking in the middle of the day when it's 101 out and there's no shade and no water. If we know certain parts of the city and certain trails are extremely hot, it just helps us back up and justify more resources being put into education.
We're not in the hottest city in Arizona by far.
No.
But you say this is still important to know what's going on here.
Sure. You know, just because it's hotter in Phoenix doesn't mean this isn't something we should be caring about. They have more traffic in Phoenix. They have more people going to the hospital. They have pretty much more of everything. That doesn't mean we shouldn't care about traffic or extreme heat. I mean, Phoenix is hotter than Chicago.
And Chicago is where this story is heading next, because it's also one of the 18 cities where volunteers are mapping the urban heat island this summer. My colleague Chris Bentley picks it up from here.
Phoenix is hotter than Chicago. That's why after 8 years, Peggy Lambert moved back here to the Windy City.
My last summer there, it was 120, like 3 days in a row. I was like, I need to move. Like, it was terrible.
She's a volunteer for Chicago's heat mapping survey. On this late July morning, the forecast calls for 90 degrees, not as hot as Arizona. But Lambert points out, more humid. Oppressive humidity is one of the reasons that in 1995, a heat wave in Chicago killed more than 700 people. It got national attention and woke up many cities to the danger of extreme heat. And it exposed another grim reality. The highest death toll was among older Black residents in a handful of poorer neighborhoods.
And I particularly remember how tragic it was losing a lot of people.
Adela Bass is a health equity organizer with the group People for Community Recovery.
I was about 4 years old, but I distinctively remember having to go to cooling centers, living in low-income neighborhoods. We didn't have air conditioning units, and that was the next following summer is when my mom bought an air conditioner and made sure we had one in our room.
Bass carries lessons from the 95 heat wave with her today. She's helping coordinate this heat watch, for one, and when it's hot, she checks in on her neighbors who don't have AC. That's something she wants the city to do more of, too.
Just creating heat watch groups, advocates to go door to door and check on those seniors who may not have that family member, that relative, that neighbor, or isn't safe with the people that live on her block.
Bass is right to worry about her neighbors. Scientists who studied the heat wave found older people living alone were at the greatest risk of dying, on par with people who had underlying medical conditions. And that other point Bass makes, the need to feel safe, it gets at something important. Gun violence and the fear of it keeps people apart. So does disinvestment. When vacant lots replace homes and businesses, neighbors lose comfortable spaces to come together and a sense of connection. So it isn't just the temperature that kills. It's the social isolation.
I mean, communities like ours, it's a transportation desert. It's a food desert. Like, you can't really get to a cooling center. You're going to be waiting at a bus stop for like 45 minutes.
Gina Ramirez is an environmental justice worker on Chicago's industrial southeast side. They have some parks and a stretch of Lake Michigan shoreline to help cool off. But there's a lot of heavy manufacturing here, too, from a massive Ford plant that employs much of the neighborhood to a nearby BP refinery. Ramirez was a kid in 1995, but the heat wave is seared into her memory.
Your house was like an oven. I remember my brother kept going upstairs to take a nap, and my dad was like constantly like, you can't nap. Like, let's go for a ride in the car. So I was like, this is really serious and terrifying.
Ramirez says it seemed like city officials in the 90s had abandoned them. The Commissioner of Human Services blamed the victims for neglecting to take care of themselves. Here's then Mayor Richard Daley.
We all have our little problems, but let's not blow it out of proportion.
Today, local leaders sound a lot different. Kyra Woods is a climate advisor to Mayor Brandon Johnson.
We're talking about disparities not only with historic policies around what types of developments get to go where, but then also disparities around chronic conditions as well.
She wants the city to develop resiliency hubs that she says could distribute disaster response beyond City Hall. That could mean community groups lead the way in coordinating check-ins and distributing city resources during a heat wave. There's no formal plan for that yet, but Wood says today's volunteer heat watch is a step in the right direction.
This is an awareness campaign, a way to get people plugged in for future conversations, and a way to open the door for short-term, midterm, and long-term solutions.
All of this is about building what the sociologist Eric Kleinenberg, who studied the Chicago heat wave extensively, calls social infrastructure. The good news is it goes hand in hand with green infrastructure like trees and parks that soothe that urban heat island effect.
So here we are sitting in this lovely park shaded by trees. Like, we are sitting here in the middle of peak heat, and there are very few parts of this playground that are in the sun. It's amazing.
Elena Grossman runs the Climate and Health Institute at the University of Illinois Chicago. I met her on a toasty afternoon in Oz Park, where people were taking walks, playing tennis, and letting their dogs drink from a pet water fountain. This park is in one of the wealthiest and whitest neighborhoods in the city. But Grossman says building more green spaces in every neighborhood will help cool things down and, crucially, bring people together.
There's a lot of evidence that shows that access to green space can increase social capital. And what is social capital? It's basically when you're in a disaster situation, you have people that you can check in on and will check in on you.
Call it social capital or community resilience. It's what makes cities work for everyone. And it can save people from deadly heat, even after the city's cooling centers close at 5 p.m.